Welcome back to the GAI podcast here and there. This is Günther. Today's episode varies just a little bit from the usual. We'll be handing off the reins to Linda Di Rodi, who welcomed Dr. Kai Michael Sprenger from Germany to a virtual talk that we recorded via Zoom. In this episode, you will get a bit of the background story of Stars and Stripes Over the Rhine, which is also our current exhibit at the GAI. Now, if you would like to see the exhibit, please join us. It's still available Sunday, November 15th and Sunday, November 22nd. There are no tickets to pre-purchase, but we will have a sign-in sheet at the entrance for contact tracing and social distancing, as well as masks will be required. Enjoy these episodes, and here is Linda.
Good evening, everyone. I would like to welcome you to today's virtual talk, Uncovering History, Connecting Families, The Making of Stars and Stripes Over the Rhine, with Dr. Kai Michael Sprenger. I am Linda Di Rodi, and I am the Director of Cultural Programming at the Germanic American Institute. Thank you all for joining us today. Dr. Sprenger joins us from the University of Mainz, where he is the Managing Director of the Institute for Regional History. His career includes positions at the German Historical Institute in Rome, the University of Mainz, and the Rhineland Palatinate Ministry of Science, Education, and Culture. He joins us today to talk about the Stars and Stripes Over the Rhine exhibit, which we currently have on display at the GAI House and on our website. This project focuses on the American occupation of the Rhineland following the end of the First World War and the long-term social and cultural impact of this occupation on the region and on German-American relations. We are delighted to have a historian of Kai's caliber join us here today. Now I will turn the microphone over to Kai. Thank you all again for joining us tonight.
Linda, thank you very much. Good evening to everybody, or for my time, it's more good morning because it's 1 o'clock in the morning right now. I'm very grateful that I have the occasion and the opportunity to present my talk on a topic that is really fascinating to my point of view. And I would like to talk to you about the American occupation in Germany after World War I. And the exhibit Stars and Stripes Over the Rhine we are presenting right now at the GAI is a contribution of our Institute for Regional History to a campaign, Wunderbar Together, Germany and the US, the so-called Year of German-American Friendship, an initiative that was funded by the German Federal Foreign Office, and that was in America, in the US, to be seen last year. From October 2018 until the end of 2019, Germany and its deep ties to the US were on display all across the United States, bringing with them a collection of multifaceted projects and events revolving around business, industry, politics, education, culture, science, and as in our case, history, to highlight the unique importance of our transatlantic relations of the German-American friendship. The exhibit and the research project was also part of another initiative in Germany as part of the celebrations of the 100-year anniversary of the American presence in the Rhine and Palatinate, initiated by the government of the state of Rhineland-Palatinate and celebrated in 2018 and 2019. And the exhibit is accompanied by the film documentary Stars and Stripes Over Koblenz, produced by the German television, and both film and exhibition were shown throughout 2019 in various locations in the United States as well as in Germany. And for me, it's important to say that this exhibit was developed in close cooperation with several partners and institutions in Germany and in the United States. For example, Ancestry.com, they helped us very much with the research for the family histories. And we have a partnership with the United States World War I Centennial Commission that supported us as well. The Institute for Regional History at the Johannes Gutenberg University in Mainz has undertaken an academic project to research this phase of American occupation in Germany after World War I. In presenting the film and the exhibit, our institute wants to illustrate to both, to Germans and Americans, how long this relationship between our two countries has actually existed. Even, as you all know, this relation had to experience challenges such as the years of the Second World War, for instance. After two world wars, Germany has long proven itself a political partner and friend of the United States. Over 50,000 servicemen and women are still stationed in the state of Rhineland-Palatinate as part of the NATO commitment. Today, Ramstein Air Base remains one of the most important strategic installations of the US Air Forces in Europe. Today, the American presence is deeply ingrained in German culture due to a partnership that mainly developed after World War II. The rapid economic development and prosperity of post-Second World War Germany has always been associated with the European Recovery Program of George C. Marshall. As Secretary of State, Marshall implemented his economic program of rebuilding war-torn European nations and was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1953 for his actions. His profound knowledge and understanding of the complicated circumstances within the defeated European nations arose, at least in part, from his personal experiences during the post-World War I period. As adjutant to General John Pershing, the commander of the American Expeditionary Forces during World War I, Marshall came to the Rhine area in 1919 as part of the US occupation force. The historic background of this German-American relationship of the post-World War I period has been all but forgotten by the people of both our nations. The first American occupation of Germany during the short period from 1918 to 1923 laid the foundation, one could say, of a long or longer relationship between our two countries. These 4 years were formative in terms of politics, economics, as well as social and cultural exchange. The American doughboys, as they are often called, brought jazz, baseball, chewing gum, pancakes, and even Coca-Cola to the Rhine. While prohibition was introduced in the US, the doughboys in the Rhineland could enjoy German beer and wine, and numerous relationships, marriages, and children grew out of the contact with the German Fräuleins during this occupation period. Until this day, many Americans and Germans do not know that they share common ancestors who met during the occupation period. This, as we might call it, human aspect of the history of the first American occupation in Germany, 100 years after the First World War was ended, is, to my point of view, especially fascinating and should be part of our mission today to inform these people about their common family histories and bring them, if possible, together. I would like to give you some short introduction to the historical context, as well as to some of the aspects covered in the film, as well as in the exhibit. Why did America enter the war in 1917? President Wilson attempted to keep America out of the World War I. But since the German Empire had declared unrestricted submarine warfare in February 1917, in which US civilians were killed by the sinking of Allied passenger ships, Wilson broke diplomatic relations with Germany and declared war. In the following 1.5 years, the United States delivered huge amounts of military hardware and some 2 million soldiers of the American Expeditionary Forces to France. Under the command of General John Pershing, the engagement of the doughboys ultimately resulted in the defeat of the German armies and the end of World War I, with the conclusion of the armistice on November 11, 1918. According to official reports from during the war, 53,000 American soldiers were killed in combat, and another 63,000 died as a result of non-combat reasons, mainly from the Spanish flu. The 11th of November 1918 marked the defeat of the German Empire and the end of the German monarchy, which was soon replaced by the Democratic Weimar Republic. the armistice of Compiègne called for large-scale German demilitarization, pulling back all German forces behind the Rhine River. To make sure that the Germans would follow the terms of the armistice, the Western Rhineland included bridgeheads on the eastern bank of the Rhine around Koblenz, Cologne, and Mainz to be occupied by the victorious powers. This territory was then divided into four occupation zones: Belgian, French, British, and American. After the war, the American soldiers wanted to go home as quickly as possible. No one foresaw a four-year occupation period. The 3rd U.S. Army, later known as the Army of Occupation, which moved towards the Rhine on November 17, 1918, was composed of 250,000 men from many elements, with engineer units, the quartermaster, medical units, signal corps, transportation corps, marine corps, and even elements of the Army Air Corps. The movement of such a large army was a logistical nightmare, with the first soldiers not arriving in Germany itself until December 1st, 1918. The main body followed 2 days later, with the entire zone being occupied by December 17, 1918. The headquarters was established in Koblenz, and soon the American flag was waving over Ehrenbreitstein Fortress, a symbol of the American watch on the Rhine. The American zone of occupation covered an area from Luxembourg and the French border to the Westerwald along the Mosel River and the Rhine River between Trier and Koblenz. To the north, there was the British zone, and to the south, the French zone. By early 19, some 250,000 doughboys stood guard over an area of 2,500 square miles and a local population of round about 900,000. There were, of course, not enough barracks available for such a large force, so that hotels and private homes soon provided the soldiers with a roof over their heads. This forced billeting into the homes of the civilians often caused misunderstandings and problems between soldiers and Germans. Liaison officers were assigned to supervise the local authorities, court rulings, economy, and political activities. Differences in language and bureaucratic systems were hard to overcome by both sides. Until early 1919, it remained unclear whether or not the war was actually over. The so-called anti-fraternization order prohibited any private contact between Germans and Americans. But of course, reality soon took hold. The anti-fraternization order was finally revoked in September 1919 due to a new political situation after the Treaty of Versailles had finally been signed in June 1919. With the signing of the Treaty of Versailles on June 19, the political situation eased and the American began withdrawing men. The Western territory was given to the French, leaving the Americans with a greater area around Koblenz. Thus, the American zone was now only half of its former size. The former divisions of the Third Army returned to the States with altogether only some 19,000 men left in late 1919. Life between the Germans and the American occupation forces was a complex challenge. The armies of both nations had fought a bitter war, which resulted in many stereotypical viewpoints. The Germans were the horrible Huns, while the Americans were considered rude, unworthy, and poorly trained. The tight billets that were often found in small villages were not only the cause of disputes with local inhabitants, but also sometimes of friendly relationships. The differences in language and culture were frequently the basis of complaints, however. The doughboys enjoyed, as I told before, chewing gum. They, as in the few, in the perspective of the locals, they ate fat, rich, and oily food, consumed much more water, gas, and electricity than the locals, and were considered dangerous drivers, causing several serious traffic accidents on the narrow German roads. The doughboys also enjoyed drinking a lot of alcohol in Germany. Back home, prohibition had just been introduced. But in the Rhineland, they could purchase beer and wine, although sales or consumption of strong alcohol remained illegal. And of course, wine, and especially wine and beer, is part of the German culture in these eras. Since the doughboys were willing to pay sometimes excessive prices, even this was possible to consume hard drinks, often resulting in drunken soldiers who began fist fights. The Germans in the beginning had to tolerate a great deal. Meetings or large gatherings were prohibited. Mail and all means of communication were censored. Every German above the age of 12 had to carry ID papers at all times, and travel restrictions were imposed so that no one was allowed to move without prior permission of the American authorities. All borders were closely controlled too. Local commanders placed further limitations, which were strictly enforced by American MPs who dealt with the doughboys. Germans accused of violations against the orders of the occupation forces were brought before provost courts and often sentenced to imprisonment or hard fines. Despite these difficulties in the beginning, as time passed, the occupation became sometimes a more positive experience for both sides. It was already at the end of December 1918 that the American leadership prohibited the soldiers from buying or requisitioning food from local Germans because they didn't have any food for themselves. The Army of Occupation established instead soup kitchens for poor Germans and distributed surplus food or clothes to people in need. During Christmas, German children were given thousands of presents by the doughboys. These acts were long remembered by the people of the Rhineland. Even today's memories of the typical post-World War II GI giving a German child a candy bar actually originated between 1918 and 1923. Cooperation, for example, with civilian workers and cultural exchange between both societies was an important aspect of the occupation as well. A friendly coexistence evolved, and a unique cooperation with local officials was very important for the American occupation command. The strategic importance of the confluence of Rhine and Mosel, the major railheads, the impressive Ehrenbreitstein fortress, and the number of barracks and administrative offices were reason enough for the Americans to establish the headquarters in Koblenz. With about 56,000 inhabitants, the city of Koblenz had to take in up to 17,000 doughboys. They were housed in barracks, public buildings, and private houses. A number of American organizations made life more bearable for the doughboys, such as the YMCA, the YWCA, the Knights of Columbus, the Salvation Army, Jewish Welfare Board, and the American Red Cross. The YMCA provided music, theater productions, sporting and holiday events, a library, a snack bar, and billiard rooms in the festival hall, which was used for sport events as well. In 1919, the Knights of Columbus opened the world's largest donut bakery of its time in Koblenz. With the help of many German employees, German bakers, they produced up to 60,000 donuts a day. The donut factory and the Coca-Cola distribution center represented Koblenz's transformation into a real American city, as a newspaper put it in those days. And one person was very important during these years. This was General Henry Sherman Allen. Major General Henry Sherman Allen was born 1859 in Kentucky. He graduated from West Point and he served as a military attaché in Berlin already in 1897. So one can say that to some extent he knew the Germans already. In 1919, Allen became the commander of the newly formed American forces in Germany. General Allen believed in a friendly, well-balanced treatment of the German population, and he wanted more cooperation with the local authorities. In 1923, he published his Rhineland Journal, which was also translated into German. And in this book, he describes his work in World War I and in the occupation zone. in 1927, he published a second book, The Rhineland Occupation. In both of his books, Alan reports in great detail on his difficult role as a mediator between the occupying powers, especially France and Germany, and he also expresses his wish to create a peaceful post-war order. Alan regretted that the United States were slightly withdrawing from European affairs instead of using the economic power to support economic and political recovery in Germany. Alan was gravely concerned about the starving children of the Rhineland. Upon his return to the United States in 1923, he became one of the founders of the American Committee for Relief of German Children, which raised $4.3 million to provide meals for over 1 million needy children, pregnant women, or young mothers. And in 1925, the General Henry T. Allen Fund was set up, collecting money for needy children of the Rhineland over many years. Until this very day, underprivileged children and adolescents annually receive small sums of money from the General Henry T. Allen Fund through the youth welfare offices in Koblenz and Mainz. Last year, around 14,000 dollars were given to the youth welfare offices in Koblenz and Mainz by this still existing General Henry Allen Fund. The bronze relief on the backside of his tombstone at Arlington National Cemetery shows Allen surrounded by thankful children. The scene refers to his charity work for the poor and starving German children of the Rhineland. And one can read in grateful commemoration of the noble services rendered to the suffering children of Germany by Henry T. Allen. The US military controlled and censored everything that was printed in the Rhineland, from pamphlets to books. Any negative comments resulted in heavy fines, a ban on publishing, and even confiscation of the publishing house equipment. In the occupation zone, smaller unit newspapers were soon published. The first was the Fourth Corps Flair in Mayen, noted as the only American newspaper printed in Germany. The main and most important American newspaper in the Rhineland was the so-called AMAROC News. This is an abbreviation of American Army of Occupation, AMAROC News. And up to 60,000 copies a day were printed in Koblenz between April 19, 1919 and the end of the occupation period. The edition of the 28th of June 1919 is related to quite a sad story. On June 28, 1919, the victorious powers in Germany signed the Treaty of Versailles. A few hours later, two US pilots took off with around 40,000 copies of a special issue of the AMAROC News concerning the peace agreement, which they dropped over the American zone to bring the joyful news immediately even to the remote areas. One of the pilots, Captain Walter Schulze, crashed during this mission in Montabaur and died shortly afterwards of his injuries. Ironically, the peace messenger, Captain Schulze, became the last American to be killed during World War I. By request of his parents, his body was transferred to the United States in 1920. In 1922, a memorial column was erected in his honor in Montabaur. But the Nazi regime destroyed this monument of remembrance at the end of the 1930s because, to their point of view, it was too reminiscent of the shameful peace of Versailles. Schulze's grave is now at the West Point Military Cemetery in the US. And last year, we had a very nice ceremony in Montabaur to commemorate 100 years of his death. The American occupation of the Rhineland can be regarded a period of cultural transfer between both peoples. The Germans were introduced to American customs, such as horse shows, American food, such as donuts and Coca-Cola, or the regularly held military band concerts presented in public areas so that local Germans could hear a very different type of military music. River cruises and sightseeing trips provided by the YMCA managed to show the doughboys many local sites like the numerous castles along the Rhine and Mosel or even Roman remains at Trier. Many American doughboys had strong ties to Germany since their ancestors had emigrated over the past centuries. And looking at the archive sources and lists of the troops in these years, we can see that quite a lot of these soldiers had German ancestors, and some of them still understood and spoke German as a mother language. With the doughboys, several previously unknown sports were introduced to the Rhineland, such as basketball, football, and in particularly baseball. One of the first baseball diamonds in Germany was built by the city of Mayen, especially for the American soldiers, as early as March of 1919. And since several professional athletes had joined the American military, a real baseball league arose. In May 1919, an army of occupation in Neuwied was watched by several German civilians. It was regarded as the official introduction of baseball in Germany. The American national sport became quite popular in the Rhineland, and the Knights of Columbus established an umpire training school in Koblenz. Mr. William Paul Coughlin, the maestro of the hidden ball trick, as he was called, a former well-known professional third baseman from the National Baseball League, having played for the Washington Senators and later Detroit Tigers, became its first director. The YMCA was the main sponsor for these baseball events, and up to June 30, 1919, they had sponsored with 925,000 Reichsmarks, which is really a huge amount of money at that time. They had sponsored 119,000 baseball, 10,000 baseball bats, and so on. So you can see this was not just a single event. This was a real introduction of baseball in Germany. Now, German and American relationships. Despite the early anti-fraternization order, some private relationships existed nevertheless. Since many German men had been killed during the war, were crippled or suffered from post-traumatic stress, the Germans' Fräuleins were attracted to the good-looking doughboys, of course. While the majority of the civilian population was suffering from poverty and hunger, the American soldiers lived in plenty with enough money to indulge the young women. In Koblenz, the local authorities were concerned about the liberal nature of some of the women and often made serious negative comments in their official records, simply stating, together with Americans, slept with American, thus making them suspect for prostitution, which was heavily fined. Even after the anti-fraternization order was finally revoked, both German and American authorities were still skeptical about these relationships. And after a short while, the first German-American children were born. Some doughboys took their new wives and children back home to the US. This was also the case of the American author Charles Bukowski, who was born to an American father and a German mother in Andernach in 1920, moving to the United States or back to the States in 1923. During World War II, such an Americana kind, as we call it, played a prominent role in history, Karl Heinrich Timmermann, who was born in Frankfurt in 1922. His German-American parents married and later moved to Nebraska. On March 7, 1945, Lieutenant Timmermann, by that time an American officer serving in the 27th Armored Infantry Division, successfully led his unit across the famous Ludendorff Bridge at Remagen, the same bridge the doughboys had crossed already in 1918, and he became the so-called hero of the Remagen Bridge. One of the most prominent American military leaders of the United States also had a what we call romantic affair in the Rhineland, General Douglas MacArthur. Being as the commander of the 84th Infantry Brigade, after the war, he was lodged with his staff in the Villa Schönberg in Sinzig. Here, he fell in love with Hertha Häuser, the landlord's daughter, who nursed him back to health while he was recuperating from the after effects of his war injuries. Upon receiving orders to return to the United States in April 1919, MacArthur gave a grand farewell dinner, to which he invited Hertha Häuser too. this relationship clearly violated the still in existence, still valid anti-fraternization order. Until 1921, he regularly wrote poetic love letters to the charming German lady who did not wish to immigrate to the US. And in 1922, MacArthur married an American, Louise Cromwell Crook. Others, however, did not want to get married and left their girlfriend and child in the Rhineland. But sometimes they were forced to pay alimony nevertheless. After the departure of American forces, many illegitimate children remained in the Rhineland, the so-called American children, as or Amerikaner Kinder, as we say. And these Amerikaner Kinder were a major concern for both sides. The support by several local agencies had to be coordinated, especially for poverty-stricken single mothers. However, not everyone received support because numerous women lacked the courage to make their situation known. Especially in small villages, shame and fear, along with the social stigma and religious belief, overshadowed sometimes this problematic reality. Many family ties with American relatives therefore remain forgotten or unknown. But today, modern technology like DNA analysis and genealogical database such as provided by Ancestry, along with historical research, can locate family members even a century later. And this was the case of Johannes Heibel's father presented in the film. And here in this article, you can see these two grand cousins, German and American, and they found each other by using these genealogical database and DNA analysis. And I was a testimony in a way when these guys first met in Frankfurt in fall 2018. And this was really moving to see these two grand cousins facing each other for the first time ever and discovering their common history that dates back to the First World War. While the doughboys and Germans were getting used to each other, politicians in Berlin and Washington attempted to lay the political foundations for the future relationship between both countries. Many American politicians were critical towards the Treaty of Versailles. After coming into office in 1921, President Harding gradually redirected U.S. foreign policy towards isolationism, reducing American involvement in Europe. And when the Treaty of Versailles came into force in January 1920, the United States and Germany technically still remained at war. After months of negotiations, the state was ended with the German-American Peace Treaty of Berlin, signed in August 1921. This treaty actually approved many terms of the Treaty of Versailles, but relieved the United States of any responsibilities in post-war Europe and any engagement in the League of Nations. Germany, on the other hand, was granted the right to settle compensatory payments directly with the US, leaving the other allies out of the picture. The treaty went into effect on November 11, 1921, and both nations once again established diplomatic relations. Due to isolationist foreign policy and improved German-American relations, support for continued occupation dwindled among American politicians and public opinion. The end of the American forces in Germany on the Rhine came with the occupation of the Ruhr by the French. Despite all warnings of the British and the American government, French and Belgian forces invaded the German Ruhr area in January 1923. In this context, the American government decided to end the Rhineland occupation, and General Allen received orders to bring home all remaining doughboys. On January 24, 1923, at 12 o'clock at Ehrenbreitstein Fortress, the American flag was lowered. 3 days later, the French officially took control of the American occupation zone. They quickly demonstrated their unquestionable authority to the Germans, making the life of the locals much harder. Reichskommissar Hermann von Hatzfeld-Wildenburg met General Allen one last time during the farewell ceremonies. He said to Allen that the beginning of a political friendship between Germany and America had been made. The Americans had arrived as enemies, as he put it. but they departed in friendship, hoping that the Germans would continue to respect humanity and a sense of justice. In retrospect, he was correct. The short period between 1918 and 1923 later served as a model in the character of the American occupation of Germany after World War II. Or, as Allen had put it in January 1923 in his farewell speech, "I am confident that this spirit of justness and fairness, applauded by our allies, will in the days to come prevent any feeling of bitterness or rancor towards us in the minds of those among whom we had lived, and will mark a forward step in the accomplishment of a genuine peace." He was right, as the short period between 1918 and 1923 represented, as at least in part, the model for the character of the future American occupation of Germany after World War II. And the last slide I would like to show you is a little small insight in ongoing research. Right now, we're having an American student with us in our institute, and he got a bit into this topic, researching family histories. And he found the American father of Elisabeth Kaspari. Elisabeth Kaspari was born in 1922 in Mayen near Koblenz. And nobody knew the name of the father, of the American father, and we found it in an archive. And now we're trying to get into contact with the descendants of this American soldier. And we sent him a letter a couple of days ago, because we got to know the name and address of some of his descendants. And now we're trying to bring these two families together. So this is quite amazing, I think, and we are very looking much forward to know what's going to happen when these two families got to know that they still have American and German relatives they didn't know before. Thank you very much for your patience and your interest, and I'm really ready to get into discussion with you and to answer some questions in case you have some. Thank you.
Okay. Hi, everyone. My name is Erin Hart. I work with the Germanic American Institute. I will ask the first question then, since I'm here. Yep. I've been wondering, I've been meaning to ask you this for a while, actually. Is how did your research originate, or how did the sort of what was the seed that grew this project, or how did you decide to do this research?
Yeah, thank you. A bit it was by accident, I should say, because our institute is interested in the history of the region of the Rhine-Pfalz area. And of course, the presence, or the strong presence, of the Americans after World War II is quite an interesting topic. And we started to do some research on this. And there's a link in my own biography, because I grew up in Mainz, directly beside an American housing area and American barracks. So the presence of the Americans was part of my early youth already. And so I got interested in this topic. And when I got a bit deeper into in the research of the presence of the Americans after World War II, in a publication, I found just two or three sentences that the Americans had been here before after World War I. And I was really astonished, because I have never heard about that in school or at university. And I thought, this is amazing that this period is completely forgotten. And so I stumbled into that first American occupation in Germany.
Wow, thank you for that. Yeah, as a former history major and German major in my studies, I also had no idea, and it's really fascinating. And thank you for uncovering this. We have a question from one of our participants. He says his grandfather was stationed in Altenahr in 1918 and 1919. And he asks if you know anything particular about the American occupation in Ortschaft. Is that a region?
In Andernach or in Andernach?
It's Altenahr in 1918 and Ortschaft.
Ortschaft. Yeah, we could research this bit because we have lists with many names, and we have lists with the names when which company was billeted in what village. So there are sources, definitely sources on that, and if I have the name and the year, maybe we could do something about this.
Okay, so maybe we could connect the two of you.
Yeah, that'd be great. And for us, it's always quite interesting, especially if these families still have some photos or letters, because for us it's quite interesting how the American soldiers looked at their time in Germany. You know, how did they experience their time being stationed in Germany? So these individual testimonies and these individual sources for our research are quite important. So
he has added that he was a second lieutenant in the U.S. Field Artillery, and he does have a postcard and some handwritten notes from his grandfather.
That would be very interesting.
The firsthand accounts you're looking for, exactly. So one of our participants asked if the film documentary is available on YouTube, and it is. I can share a link in the chat, or I can. It's available on our website. If you go to gai-mn.org/chapters, we have the English version of the film. We might also have the German. I'd have to double check, but we do have the film available on our website. Okay. If anyone else has other questions, please feel free to enter them in the chat, or if you would like to turn on your camera and ask yourself, I think we would welcome that. We're a small enough group on this Friday night here. Okay. I have one more question for you, Kai, since I have the microphone. I was wondering if you could speak a little more about sort of the next phase of your project. You mentioned your student, Daniel, who is conducting some more research on connections, but sort of what does the next chapter for you and your institute look like?
Yeah, there are actually two chapters, or actually three. First of all, we would like that this exhibit and the film and the topic be known more in the US. So we would be very glad if this exhibit could be shown or could be on display in other towns and cities as well. And I think this was the main intention, to have this exhibit traveling during the next years in the United States. And of course, to doing this, to get into contact with descendants of former doughboys that had been stationed in Germany. This is one step. The next step is we found that in many libraries and archives in the US, there are huge amounts of individual letters. And one next step will be to research these letters, to look at the individual experiences of the doughboys in Germany. And these are quite different, of course, because some doughboys who had been in Germany only for 2 or 3 months, they still perceive and see and look at Germans and Germany with these stereotypical viewpoints and propaganda pictures. But some doughboys who had been long in Germany for a year or 2 years, sometimes we can see that they change a bit their point of view, their viewpoints. So this is an interesting step, interesting move in research during the next years. And of course, Our main interest is right now these individual stories of these so-called Americana Kinder, because we're in contact on the German side with more than 20 individuals being the grandsons and granddaughters of these almost unknown American grandfathers. And for me, it's quite interesting to see how these people approach that individual family story. So for them, it's more the point to get to know their family history, and it's not so much the point whether this relation had been a real love or just a short affair, or sometimes what happened, of course, as well, rape and violence. But they want to know, do I have American relatives or do I have German relatives? And we would very much like to get into contact, or more into contact, with American families who did not know that they have this story. And so we hope to approach and to get a bit to get a bit deeper into that. And this emotional experience for me is very interesting and very moving in a way, because just a couple of days ago, I was in contact with one granddaughter of an American soldier, and she knew the name, and she knew when this guy got back to Chicago in 1919, but she had a DNA analysis just recently, and she found her cousin, and when she called me 3 days ago, she was crying. So because this emotional aspect of this history, of these individual family histories, I think this is something that is, of course, historic research, but it's much more. It tells a story that has not been told yet. And I think this is some sort of mission, and I would like to work on that mission, but not only in Germany, but I would like to involve as many American families as possible.
Well, I definitely hope that we can help you do that. And for sure, you know, having the exhibit reach other Americans and sort of the word about this history will be very important. So thank you for sharing that. That sounds so exciting. We have one question from one of our audience members. He's asked how he could share his grandfather's letters home. Is it sort of to put him in touch with you and your institute?
That'd be great. Yeah, that'd be nice. Thank you very much for that.
Definitely. Yes. Thank you. And thank you also to another one of our members who said he would be happy to share the documents from his grandfather with you. So I'll make sure to, I think you're both members, so I'll make sure to connect you, or you could email me at communications@gai-mn.org, and I'll make sure to exchange your contacts. Kai, I'd like to thank you on behalf of everyone here and everyone at the GAI. I think that our audience we're really appreciative. And we've really enjoyed being in contact with you and working with you on this exhibit. And we'll do all that we can to continue sharing this important research with as many people as we can.
Thank you very much.